This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Despite what we have seen transpire this week, another horrific terrorist attack in France, there was actually history made this week. What is interesting is that a lot of the history being made, such as the changes in Social Security last year, are rather not record-breaking, but radical changes, which are the harbingers of the things that are to come and will by far affect the world more pronouncedly than some of the things the media are regularly covering or our candidates are discussing. Now, what is this historic moment? Well, bond yields got to levels we have never seen before in the history of since we've been producing bonds. There were multiple auctions in Europe and in the U.S., and governments have been issuing bonds at the lowest rates in U.S. history. And some of these were actually in negative territory. So you have to understand the bizarre nature of what that means. I'm going to give you my money and I'm going to pay you money for giving you my money. It's strange.
Well, that's what happened in Germany this week. The German government issued 10-year bonds at a negative interest rate of 5 basis points. Now, obviously, when they're issuing bonds at negative interest rates, John, I would only imagine it would be institutions that would buy this because they need to park their money somewhere. As we have mentioned so many times in this program, the world is awash with liquidity. It's behind much of this recent rise that you've seen in the stock market. So if you're a corporation, you're an institution, a pension fund, you got to put your money somewhere and you want to put it safely. You don't want to put it all in stocks because stocks can go up and down. So they sold a 10-year bond at a negative 5 basis points, meaning whoever bought that bond is going to lose money. Across the pond in the U.S., the U.S. sold a 30-year treasury bond. That's, folks, this is interest rates 30 years out. I have no clue what interest rates are going to be 30 years from now. But the government sold $12 billion worth of 30-year bonds at 2.17% interest rate. That surpassed the low reached at the beginning of last year in 2015. The Treasury issued some 30-year bonds. A lot of the debt financing of the Treasury has been on the short side where they're paying next to nothing for the debt. Because as I pointed out, in 2015, the government spent $20 billion more on interest expense versus what they did 8 years ago when they had $9 trillion less in debt. But last January, they issued a bond at 2.43, this week at 2.17. And here's the remarkable thing. As low as that interest rate was, the bid to cover ratio, it was like for every dollar bond supplied, they had bids 2.5 times that. In other words, it was oversubscribed. And if you think that's bad, if Germany was bad, Switzerland issued bonds this week at a negative interest rate of 23 basis points. In other words, a little over 0.2% negative. So on a $100,000 bond, you'd be losing a couple $100 a year on that bond to the Swiss government. So it just goes to prove with the crisis that we saw, the tragic crisis in France on Thursday, in times of crisis, the U.S. Treasury is the most sought-after asset class in the world. And anytime there's a crisis, whatever it is, financial, geopolitical, money gravitates where it is most liquid and can be treated best.
You know, you're going to have to tell me, why is everybody into treasuries? I mean, the U.S. is in deficits right now, and let's face it, the economy's not that great.
I mean, if you look at all that ocean of money that's out there in the world today, first of all, the U.S. Treasury market is the largest, most liquid market in the world. I'm sure a lot of these people that are parking their money on these negative interest rate bonds or at least positive interest rate bonds here in the U.S., they may not keep it there. But they have to put the money somewhere, and they want to put the money where it's going to be most liquid. So if you're in treasuries, you know you can get out of them. You might get out of them at a slight loss, but at least they're liquid. So we have the largest, most liquid market in the world. Secondly, the U.S. economy accounts for almost 25% of world GDP. It's about 22%. So it's the largest economy, and quite honestly, if you take the G7, it's the best growing economy out of those 7 countries. So if you're taking a look at where you're going to park your money, well, you're going to park it at a place that's fairly safe and stable. You're going to park it at a place that's most liquid if you want to get out. and you want to park it at a place where at least the economy is doing somewhat better than most economies elsewhere. So, John, that's kind of what makes the U.S. Treasury market what it is. And, you know, the other thing is, what are the alternatives? Are you going to put your money in German bonds and lose money, or in Switzerland and lose money? At least if you're putting money in the U.S., you are getting a positive return. And so that's why the Treasury this week was able to issue 30-year bonds at 2.17%, you know, less than 2.2%. And they were gobbled up.
Yeah, but if you buy down here at the level, I mean, isn't there some kind of risk? Because there have been times past when you look at what the rate within 6 months doubled. And so then you're stuck.
Well, the rates have already backed up as money rotates out of bonds back into stocks. The 10-year note is back up to almost 1.6%. And that 30-year bond that was issued at 2.17, bonds, 30-year bonds on this Friday are at 2.3%. So if you bought that bond on Tuesday, you already lost money, and you've lost money in Treasury. So you're down slightly, not that much, but you've already lost money. Of course, there's a danger of losing money when you're buying rates this low, and that's one of the risks of being in bonds, especially longer term. Now, if you're in short-term bonds, 2 or 3 years, you can always hold them to maturity. But, you know, it's hard to believe, and it just goes to show you, when bonds move, they can move just as rapidly as stocks. In other words, you can lose money in bonds today as quickly as you can in individual stocks. I mean, the 10-year Treasury note got down to 1.36 this week, and here it is this Friday. It's back up to 1.6%, and the 30-year note is at 2.3%. So it reminds me, John, I think what you were referring to was in 2014, in May of that year, when Bernanke announced the Fed was going to start reducing taper. The 10-year Treasury note went from 1.6% to 3%. Bond investors lost double digits that year. But look what happened. 2015 and 2016, interest rates went even lower. So it's almost like a trader's market. So you might argue, well, who would want to buy negative interest rate bonds like bunds or Swiss bonds or even low-rated treasuries? A lot of times it's just large institutions, whether it's corporations sitting on trillions of dollars of cash or pension funds or foreign central banks and governments, they're looking for a short-term place to park money. So that's exactly why we have the situation that we have today, that even though we've had these sort of little bear market episodes in bonds, yields are lower today than where they were in 2014 and 2015.
Well, we know that central banks are printing money, but aside from that, why haven't we seen these yields rise? Because we know that money printing is going on globally.
Well, there are a number of factors that account for this, not just central banks. One is sluggish economic global growth. I mean, global GDP growth is anemic. They keep revising it down. They keep revising U.S. economic growth, as the Fed has already done several times this year. So number one, slower economic growth. Number two, we don't have any instances of high inflation, so we have low inflation. Three, and this is a long-term structural trend, is aging demographics. As people age, they spend less money, more on medical, so entitlement costs go up and they spend less in the economy versus, let's say, new household formations, a young family starting out. And number four, what we've been talking about over the last couple of years, accommodative interest rate policy, is QE has gone global. It started with the Fed. It began also in the UK, and they may be going back in that direction. We have it in the ECB, the Bank of Japan. Central banks are lowering interest rates, and as low as these rates are, U.S. Treasury rates almost look like junk bonds when you compare them to bonds in Japan or in Europe or elsewhere. It's hard to believe, but there are $13 trillion of sovereign debt on the globe that has a negative interest rate, meaning you are actually paying the government to loan them money.
You know, the question I always want to ask when we talk about these things, however did we get here? You know, we seem to be walking into this eyes wide shut, to quote a recent movie.
You know, it's probably the cumulative cost of political and economic choices that we've made over the last probably three decades. You know, we've really relied heavily on debt financing. We saw that in the last decade, where the total debt in the United States doubled from $28 trillion to $54 trillion. And before that, we've been doubling debt. I mean, just take a look at when George Bush came into office in 2001, the total government debt was $5 trillion. He doubled it to $10 trillion. And Obama comes in 2009, and he will double debt to $20 trillion by the time he leaves office in January. We're already over $19 trillion. And the other thing that has happened, and especially less so under Bush, but it is accelerated under Obama, is escalating regulation, rising taxation, and it's led. The result is economic sclerosis. And you remember the old cry, I remember getting in this business in the 80s, it was taxes and inflation. Well, now it's taxes and regulation. And the result is we have a lot of debt out there. And one of the reasons the economy hasn't been growing is high taxes and regulation. Credit growth is averaged only 4% a year in this economic recovery versus 9% in previous recoveries. The other thing that happened is with Dodd-Frank, the financial system was overregulated at the expense of tighter credit. If you're going to put bankers in jail and put all kinds of regulations on them, well, one of the consequences is they're not going to be loaning or making loans as readily as they would normally do. So it hampered a lot of the recovery. And then on top of that, you throw high taxes on those that create jobs in this country, high taxes, high regulation. And John, there's no talk of taxes going away. The Democrats now want to tax the securities market. In other words, if you buy a stock or a bond, they want to charge you 0.5% tax. It's kind of like, oh, we're going to get those guys on Wall Street. So you have that. And then it just isn't the Fed, even though the Fed is the world's largest central bank. All the banks, all the major central bankers around the world are involved in some form or another, with the exception of the Fed, of quantitative easing. The Bank of Japan, the ECB, and soon again, maybe the Bank of England, and soon again, maybe even the Federal Reserve. And so as a result of that, we've seen debt levels in the U.S. rise in the last 7 years under the Obama administration. We've gone from 228% debt to GDP ratio. We're now at 251%. Government debt alone is 100% of GDP versus 60% in 2007. And the problem when you borrow money, and I don't have to tell you if you're listening to this program, you go out and put a bunch of stuff on your credit cards or installment debt or mortgage debt, you're really mortgaging future consumption at the expense of current consumption. Because if you add a whole bunch of debt, one of the reasons you haven't seen credit growth is there was a lot of debt added at the consumer level in the last decade. So it doesn't matter how low interest rates are. If you're heavily laden with debt, you got credit cards, installment debt, car loans, mortgage payments, second mortgages, all that adds up. It prevents you from spending or borrowing even more, because especially under Dodd-Frank, you're going to be a poor lending risk to a bank, and banks have been tightening credit. So it's one of the reasons, John, that we're in this mess. It's been a combination of political and economic decisions that we've made, not just recently, but over decades, to emphasize debt financing growth for the economy. And now we are dealing with two detractors for economic growth: rising taxes and rising regulation. I mean, the regulations that have come out over the last 7 years are just horrific. And it's one of the reasons why you've seen the slowest and lowest job formation and company formation in the history of this country.
But I mean, as far as the consumer goes, and this is basically the bulk of the economy, right? We've had three straight quarters of declining consumer spending. What is going on if the labor market is
so the labor market data, as I said, if you just took your signal from that, we'd definitely move, I think. But if you look at the growth data, it doesn't look as good. And there's a rule of thumb within the Fed that if the labor market data and the growth data don't line up, you go with the labor market data because it's more timely and it's sort of better measured. But if you look at GDP growth in the U.S., it's only about, if you take tracking estimates for this quarter and you look at the past four quarters, including this quarter, it's only about 1.6% or something, which is below a 2% trend. So kind of below trend growth over the last year. Even if there's some rebound here in the second quarter. So I think the markets, that's a point in favor of the market's view that we're going to go slower because the GDP growth doesn't look that good.
It's James Bullard, who is president of the St. Louis Fed, interview this week. And he's saying that, well, you heard him say it, the GDP growth is not looking that good. And what he's also saying that is that interest rates are likely to remain low, which is confirming a lot of what you've been talking about here on the show. But how much lower can we go?
Well, John, we started talking about low interest rates at historic levels a month ago, and here we are this week as we started this program with Germany and the U.S. issuing bonds at the lowest record in history. So, you know, the theme is they can stay lower for a lot longer than most people think. I mean, a good example is what has happened in Japan, where rates have remained low for over two decades. In fact, they called the Japanese bond market the widowmaker because more bond traders have lost money trying to short bonds. And I know a lot of hedge funds have been losing money trying to short bonds at these low rates, only to get whacked that rates go even lower. So we've seen two decades of low interest rates. And the problem that we're facing now, as we've been talking on this program for several months here, economic growth in the U.S. is receding. We've seen a softening in trends over the last 3 months in the labor market. This second quarter profits are now coming in, and this will be the fifth consecutive quarter of corporate profits have declined. The Fed just issued its beige book this week, and it saw weakening trends across many of the districts. So, you know, there's a definite slowdown occurring that's taking place here. So you're not going to see any aggressive actions by central bankers. And I can tell you there have been more bad decisions made by hedge fund managers trying to think that they could time this market with interest rates in short the bond market. And they're getting their heads handed to them on a plate because let's put it this way. Central banks have bigger checkbooks than the money these hedge funds manage. And it's why hedge fund performance has just been horrific. And like I said, you're going up against a guy with an unlimited checkbook, and they have unlimited buying power. And so that's why you have to be really, really careful. And low rates, you know, the one thing that they have done, they've powered this market, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks with Brexit. And the other thing they've done is they've added a little bit more economic life to this recovery. So the recovery is on life support right now with lower interest rates. And by interest rates remaining low or getting lower as they have over the last month, there's a possibility that, you know, the day of reckoning with the recession has probably been postponed or pushed further out as a result of these low interest rates.
So basically, as you've been pointing out, Jim, hedge funds have been taking a real beating just trying to outguess the bottom of the market. And what this means for investors is that in reality, you're placing a big bet that the central banks are going to keep rates as low as they are currently.
Well, I mean, take a look at what happens with every time you have a financial crisis, you know, whether it's Brexit or if you go back to the beginning of the year, it was a slowdown in GDP. It was the Fed raising interest rates. It was concerns over Chinese economic growth. As a result of Brexit, we've got lower economic growth forecast now as a result of this uncertainty created in the marketplace. And what happened is you saw a lot of bond buying and people heading to safety, driving down lower interest rates. And the stock market's going up, but it's not going up because profits are going up. It's going up, and investors have a hard time understanding this. When interest rates go down as low as they are, PE ratios go up. So the market is going up, not due to profits, not due to revenue growth. It's going up to PE multiple expansion. And you normally don't see that towards the end of an economic recovery. You start seeing interest rates rise and PE ratios begin to contract. We're seeing just the opposite. People are willing to pay more to own a share of stock because what's competing? You're competing with the bond market. And if you're a bond investor looking at negative yields, or you're looking at, let's say, low yields on U.S. Treasuries, and you're saying, wait a minute, I can get 1.6% on a 10-year Treasury, or I could get 4% or 3% on a dividend stock. So a very difficult environment to navigate because what we're seeing now is an economic slowdown. We're seeing a slowdown in corporate profits, and inflation has remained low. And at some point, we know we're going to have another recession. And what the markets are saying is, you know what, central bankers, you don't have a lot of ammunition left. I mean, what's Yellen going to do? Lower the Fed funds rate from 0.5% to zero again? I mean, do you really think that's going to kickstart the economy? We'll get to what I think they're going to be doing next. But right now, the world is awash in liquidity. And where are you going to put that money? There's trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that are sitting out there looking for a home. Where are you going to put it? You going to put it in a bank that's going to charge you a negative interest rate? Or are you going to have to put it in a bond that's going to charge you a negative interest rate? And for many of these institutions, John, that's what they have to do. Because, you know, if you're a corporation and you're sitting on tens of billions of dollars of cash, where are you going to park it? You're probably going to park it in U.S. Treasury bonds. And if I look at U.S. Treasury notes, I mean, three-month T-bills pay 0.3%. Now, that may not sound like a lot of money, but folks, that's better than a negative interest rate. One-year Treasury notes are 0.5%. At least you're getting something and your money is fairly safe. And that is what has been putting this drive to lower and lower interest rates. And the more we move towards crises, whether it's terrorism, as we saw in France on Thursday in Nice, or you're seeing it with Brexit or any other crisis, money is going to gravitate for safety and liquidity, and that's the bond market.
Well, that brings up the logical question. How long can this actually go on? How long can it continue? And how low can the yields actually go?
You know, they can go a lot lower. I mean, John, we've been doing this program. What have we been telling our listeners every single week? You know, this week, we just hit historical low bond offerings, both from Germany and the U.S. Last week, we talked about how low interest rates are. They got even lower this week. And as we try to emphasize, eventually money is going to become meaningless. I mean, $1 million today only gets you $270 a year in interest on a money market fund, probably $5,000 in a two-year note, and about $15,000 on a 10-year treasury. So, you know, the only tool right now, and I think you're going to see this reversed in the next administration, and it may even begin in Japan, which will be the topic of the second point of the big picture today, is revving up the engines. Helicopter money is on its way, because eventually what you're hearing discussed in policy circles right now is government fiscal policy is going to have to reverse its trend. In other words, we're going to be moving from austerity. And we saw that, John, begin last year in November, when there was a deal cut between Congress and the president, and they got rid of the sequester and all the budget constraints. This year, it was just reported the month of June was the budget deficit this year for the government is going to be somewhere between $550 and $600 billion. It got down to as low as $400 billion. So it's already begun here in Washington in the U.S. The U.K. has scrapped its balanced budget. And if you look over at Europe, France, Italy, and Spain are pushing back on Brussels for austerity. And, you know, a good example is take a look at this year's presidential campaign. I don't care if you're looking at Donald Trump or you're looking at Hillary Clinton. John, none of these people are talking about balancing the budget. Have you noticed that? Nobody's talking about that anymore. And in fact, if anything, they're talking about free giveaway.
You notice, by the way, that the politicians are all talking about free things or more spending, you know, whether it's promises of free college or rebuilding the military. And it's really contrasting to what Professor Larry Kotlikoff has been saying lately. And I know you're going to be interviewing him coming up in the coming week as far as lifetime income on Tuesday. And he's warning this thing's rocketing out of control and no one's really taking it seriously.
No, this is an election year. And what do politicians do in an election year? You know, one of the things I've done recently is when I have the time, I'm finishing up the House of Cards series. And they're all, you know, you see so much of that, what's going on. And you just take a look at Washington, it's a mirror image of that. But what is coming is helicopter money. And what I suspect you're going to see proposed, and we're going to get a glimpse of this with the Republican platform and the Democrat platform. Both of those platforms, John, are talking about money spending. I don't care if it's infrastructure, the military, tax cuts. So you're going to see handouts, as we saw in 2010, where the government gave money to people. They lowered Social Security taxes. You're going to see, depending on which platform you're looking, whether you're looking at Democrats or Republicans, Republicans will probably try to stimulate the private economy. The Democrats will want to create government jobs. So you may see limited tax cuts and hike. So the government is going to be spending money. And this time, central bank policy will be much more effective because government will spend, let's say the U.S. government increases its budget deficit to $1 trillion. Well, the Fed will just simply print the money to pay for it and finance it. So eventually you're going to see a pivot point and a turn from deflation will be replaced by inflation. And you're already seeing it. The minimum wage is going to be raised to $15. We've done it here in California. Both presidential candidates have largely abandoned fiscal restraint. There is absolutely no talk of anybody wanting to talk about the budget deficit or fiscal restraint. And what it's going to do, John, it's going to create inflation and more unemployment, which we'll get into, because raising the minimum wage to $15, imagine if you're a restaurant owner, let's say you own a McDonald's franchise, your largest cost is labor. The government comes in and says your labor costs are going to go up 50% from $10 to $15. What are you going to do? And I'm trying to think of the fast food restaurant chain that is, you're seeing it done already, where you go in and you're going to order your food with a kiosk. You're not even going to talk to somebody, and then the machines will make the food and then somebody will serve it to you. So you will see labor displaced by technology as the government tries to create higher wage costs. But that is coming along the way.
So if we look at all of this, Jim, what that really means is that none of this stuff's working. You know, when we look at low interest, well, even negative interest rates, quantitative easing, next thing on the horizon you're going to hear rumblings of is helicopter drops. That's the only thing left. And so what does that mean? I mean, the implications of it as far as inflation especially.
Well, in the short term, the world is turning Japanese, which means, you know, the theme of this segment is rates can remain lower and longer and negative for a lot longer than you think. Economic growth is weakening, and it'll get weaker because of poor fiscal policies. You can't tax and regulate and create prosperity, and we're likely to see more taxes and more regulation. In the short term, you're seeing right now, which is what we've experienced these last 8 years, is deflation. But you also have a longer structural trend, John, which is deteriorating demographics, which is why immigration has been one way that you know, the population rate has increased, because birth rates have remained so low. So it's one of the issues in the political campaign, whether it's Brexit or even in this political campaign, the anti-immigration movement. But anyway, we have deteriorating demographics. And how this has changed the marketplace for investors, it's sort of gone from a buy and hold market as we were in the 80s and 90s. Basically, you bought a stock, you held on it. You could have held on to an S&P index fund for, you know, two decades and you made money. But think of somebody that bought an S&P index fund in the year 2000. It wasn't until April of 2013 that we finally exceeded the levels reached back in 2007 and in the year 2000. So it changes that buy and hold strategy. It's also creating a premium for growth companies. It's why people overpay for, I don't care if it's Netflix, if it's Amazon, if it's Facebook, if it's Google, all these companies, investors are willing to pay a premium for growth because we don't have much growth. As we talked about earlier, we've had, this will be, this second quarter will be the fifth consecutive quarter that we've seen S&P 500 earnings drop. But stocks, that's not to say that stocks will go up, as I talked with Ralph in the first hour. But what it means is you're going to pay more to own those stocks. So stocks could go up and can go a lot higher, almost into bubble territory, because investors, just like in the bubble of 2000, will be paying more and more to own the same stocks. And if you are saving for retirement, it means you're going to have to save a lot more. Investors are now spending rather than earning money. I mean, you take a look at the institutional level. Chances are, if you're a large corporation, you're getting nothing on your money, or an institution, you're getting nothing, or actually paying the government to loan them money. But, you know, John, we've been here before.
But Jim, when you say we've been here before, are we zooming all the way back to the Great Depression, you know, the 30s and 40s, when interest rates were much lower?
No, actually, John, there's a concept, and this is what makes what we're experiencing now somewhat unique. There's something called negative real yields, and that is you take the interest rate minus the inflation rate. And when you get negative yields in the past, and actually from 1933 to 1960, 18 of those 27 years, we saw actually negative interest rates, meaning that the rate of return that you received on a bond was less than the rate of inflation. So let's say a bond was returning 3%, but inflation was running 4%, the interest rate you were getting was actually less than the inflation rate. And what makes this so unique right now is fundamentally it's different than anything in the past. In the past, when we had negative rates, It was because inflation. This time, John, we have negative interest rates that are being created by the demand for money in central banks buying bonds. So it's much, much different. And in the same thing that happened in the 1970s, interest rates lagged the real inflation rate. It was hard to believe, but it wasn't until roughly about 1980 and 81 where you got interest rates above the inflation rate. 1980, CPI was 14.5%. So if you bought a bond that was paying 12%, you were actually losing money because inflation was greater than the interest rate you received. So what makes negative interest rates different this time? It's the result of central bank policies which failed to produce inflation. So until we get to a point where lenders write off bad debts, financial repression will continue to transfer massive amounts of wealth from savers to borrowers. And unfortunately, John, in the 80s and 90s, the markets did most of the heavy lifting in investment returns. You just put your money in the market. I don't care if you bought a bond fund, a stock or a stock fund, it went up every year. Well, now with rates negative or low or next to nothing, savers are going to have to save more money. So it's going to be a completely different world. And a lot of individuals are going to see that their financial goals may not be realized because they have not adapted to this new marketplace. It's probably one of the most difficult marketplaces to operate in as an investor or even a money manager that I've seen, John, in my, 35, 36-year career in the business.
Well, if we posit the idea that central banks are out of ammo, you also look at the fact that economic growth rates are slowing and we're obviously moving towards a recession. As far as governmental policy, we have high taxes, high regulation. These basically have a stranglehold on the economy, which is one of the reasons businesses aren't doing so great. Until we get around to the helicopter drops, it just simply means, I guess, from this point on, that interest rates are going to be lower for a lot longer. And so you might as well plan on it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's a William Warren Fairfield Professor at Boston University. He's an author, and he's also a write-in candidate for the presidential race in 2016. Professor, let's begin with Social Security. The Social Security Trustee Fund released the report a couple of weeks ago, and talking about that the liabilities of Social Security keep increasing, you have a figure of unfunded liability or a fiscal gap of $199 trillion. So let's talk about the Social Security Trust Fund report, which nobody is talking about, and then also your own numbers.
The $199 trillion is the fiscal gap for the entire fiscal enterprise, including Social Security, and that's the value in the present of all projected future spending expenditures, including servicing the official debt out till the end of time. But you're making numbers that are very far out, you're discounting them, and discounting means to make less of them. So you're making them smaller because they're not worth as much because they're very far away in the future. So we economists have a natural way to adjust for that. So you get the present value of all the spending that's projected by the CBO, and you get the present value of all the taxes projected by the CBO, and the difference is the fiscal gap, and it's the true red ink that the country faces. It's putting everything on the books. It's not leaving Social Security obligations and Medicare and Medicaid and defense spending obligations all off the books because they're all there. You know, you have to pay for those things. It's not like we're never going to have a Defense Department or a military. So we're $199 trillion in the red. So the country is dead broke. That $199 trillion is 53% of the present value of taxes. So that Another way of saying this is that we're 53% underfinanced, and we need a 53% immediate and permanent tax hike. And that number will go up to more like 70% if we wait 20 years. So our kids will face an even bigger disaster, you know, if we just sit back and say, oh, they'll handle it. So it's generational warfare, fiscal child abuse that we're involved in.
Obviously, you probably recognize the very famous scene from the movie Apocalypse Now, the helicopters attacking to the music by Wagner, The Ride of the Valkyries. So in economic terms, as we just discussed in the last part of the section, helicopters are coming, and you have to really ponder the idea that maybe this is a last-ditch effort to prop things up because nothing else has worked. And après moi, le déluge, right? After me, the deluge, if that doesn't work. So does it look like a last-ditch effort?
Well, some are actually calling this monetary apocalypse. I mean, if you look after the financial crisis in 2007 and 2009, the first thing the Fed did is dropped interest rates from over 5% down to 0.25%. Then we got the lowest rates in history. That was followed by quantitative easing. That didn't work, and now we have negative interest rates around the globe. So it's kind of like, what's next? And John, that's exactly it. I mean, what else are they going to do? Negative interest rates aren't working in Japan. People are actually buying safes, stuffing it in mattresses, and buying gold. So that is really not going to make it. I mean, for the big guys, they have no choice but to buy these negative interest rate bonds that we've been talking about in the first hour. So, you know, this is probably next on the agenda. And that's why you are hearing both presidential candidates here and abroad talking about helicopter money. They don't call it helicopter money, but they talk about fiscal stimulus, which is another word for helicopter money coming.
You know, you have to ponder what it is they're thinking about, because if we look at everything they've done so far, it hasn't worked. The economy is, it's not really moribund, but it's not really doing very much. Jobs haven't increased very well. All of this stuff together. And you have to wonder, do these people really understand what they're doing? That this doesn't work at a certain point? Or is it just desperation, you know, like a terminally ill patient? Let's just do something. I don't care what it is.
You know what, John? It is really the economic system, the economic philosophy. There was an analyst on Wall Street that published a piece this week, and it was called The Portrait of Quantitative Failure. Now, just listen to this. The futures market, forget interest rates this year. The futures market talks about the first FOMC meeting where they actually might raise interest rates is December 17, not December 2016, December 17, where there's a 40% probability of rate hikes. Think about this. There have been 659 global cuts in interest rates since the Lehman crisis. There are $13 trillion outstanding sovereign bonds that have a interest rate that is negative. There is almost $25 trillion outstanding of global central bank holdings of financial assets. That's money that was created out of thin air. If you look around the globe, the most negative interest rate bond is a three-year government Swiss bond. The yield is a negative 1.1%. So imagine if you had $1 million and you invested in that three-year note, you would be losing almost a little over $10,000 a year in interest. Now, here's something that puts this into perspective. If you take a look at how low interest rates are, it would take you 107 years to double your savings in a one-year deposit account at a bank. It would take you almost 1,400 years to double your savings in a German bank. It would take you almost 7,000 years to double your money in a Japanese bank account. You kind of wonder, folks, why they're buying safes. It's probably the only way you can actually preserve your capital. If you take a look at investor cash, it's the highest since it's been since the bursting of the tech bubble. It's almost at 5.7%. So investors aren't sanguine, despite the fact that the stock market is hitting new records. Corporations are sitting on $1.6 trillion of corporate cash. The labor market participation rate has not been this bad since 1978 under Jimmy Carter. There are a lot of people that are attributing the Obama administration's policies to Carter. There are 21 million unemployed men and women in Europe. The unemployment rate for youth in Greece, Spain, and Italy are 49%, 45%, and 39%. And the growth in Japanese economic GDP in 8 years is 0.16%, less than 0.2%. And if you take a look at what has happened this year with dropping interest rates, the annualized return on 30-year bonds, 25%. That's why so many hedge fund managers lost money this year. They were shorting the bond market, and they just got walloped by central banks. So the net result is, John, a failure of quantitative easing. It has not worked. And more importantly, it's produced inequality on Wall Street, incited by the belief that every single interest rate in the world is heading to zero. And you're seeing this in the mountain of cash on the sidelines is induced this irrational upside in government and corporate bonds and high and high quality stocks. And it's another reason why you've seen gold and silver turn out to be the most outstanding investment this year. And it's what people are doing because money is losing its value in terms of return. You can't earn anything on money.
What we do have is bad economic policy, and I'm not hearing any of it come out of the election campaigns that I like, and they're just proposing more and more of the same bad policies. One of the proposals I heard come from the Democratic Party was they want to punish Wall Street. That's it. I ran into a guy on the street that he's progressive, I'm not, and we had a very spirited conversation for 25 minutes. We enjoyed it, but got to go get Wall Street. Got to get Wall Street because that's going to make us all better if we go attack Wall Street. So the proposal now is, you know, a tax of what? 0.5% to 0.1% on all transactions. Now, this sounds really good, like we're going to, quote, get Wall Street. But in reality, you're penalizing investors. You're penalizing people who have pensions and other investment plans that depend on that as well. So this just more and more and more tax. It doesn't help the economy at all. And that reminds me, Jim, of something. I was listening to Milton Friedman from back several decades, and he said something that just sounds as fresh and as pertinent today about politics as it was then.
You know, people have a great misunderstanding about this. People in Congress are in a business. They're trying to buy votes. They're in the business of competing with one another to get elected. The same congressman will vote for a different thing if he thinks that's politically profitable. You don't have to change Congress. People have a great misconception in this way. They think the way you solve things is by electing the right people. It's nice to elect the right people, but that isn't the way you solve things. The way you solve things is by making it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right things.
I thought that was really good. It's to make it profitable for the wrong people to do the right things.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that was said a couple decades ago. And how pertinent is that, as you pointed out, to today? And the problem is we're dealing with taxes and regulation, and it's counterproductive to monetary policy. It's one of the reasons why the Fed has gone through a series of moves of not only lowering interest rates to zero, then they tried quantitative easing, and central banks around the world are trying negative interest rates. The next thing they're going to do, John, is helicopter drops. And the problem with governments running the economy, the government does everything inefficiently. It's not as efficient as the private sector. But it doesn't matter how poor the results, as I just read them to you, you cannot tell that to a politician because politicians run on kissing babies and promising lollipops. And we're getting that this year in the election. The problem is it is counterproductive to monetary policy, and hence the failure to revitalize our economic growth. And it creates a wealth disparity as a result of central bank policy, because you are transferring wealth from savers and investors to borrowers. And the biggest beneficiary is the government itself. It pays less to issue debt. And one of the reasons you have wealth inequality is if you're a family, you're struggling, you know, between taxes, between debt payments, you're barely making it. It doesn't matter that the stock market is going up if you don't have the money to take advantage of it. And so people that do have money obviously can make more money because they can invest. But the middle class is struggling because of taxes and regulation. They haven't had wage increases. A lot of that is coming from factors of globalization, which is the anti-globalization trend you're seeing now. And a lot of it is technology. Technology, I mean, the U.S. is making more stuff today with fewer workers as a result of robots. So these policies are failing, and it's creating a lot of consequences. They're unable to generate the economic growth, although they keep promising. They're unable to generate wage growth, although they keep promising. And they're unable to generate inflation. So the net result is going to be helicopter money.
Well, you are hearing this chatter. You're hearing it here. You're definitely hearing it overseas. This week, former Fed Chair Bernanke was in Japan, and he was pretty much recommending helicopter drops over there. So it would seem that they don't get this yet.
No. In fact, there was a Fed governor this week. Her name was Loretta Mester. She's the Fed governor of the Bank of Cleveland, and she's also a voting member on the FOMC. In a speech this week, she hinted at what we need to consider or look at is payments to households and to businesses. And she also talked about if there's an event of another shock of some form or another, or an economic downturn, the most likely option coming from the Fed will be quantitative easing style money printing coupled with some kind of fiscal stimulus. Because the problem is helicopter money is the only way that you can directly pump money into real economy if you're not getting it through the banking system through loans and credit. And you're seeing more and more talk about it because, as we pointed out, credit growth in this recovery has been anemic because we already have too much debt. If you have too much debt, you can't borrow money. So the government, through regulation of the banks with Dodd-Frank, banks are more circumspect in lending. They're not making as much loans, or it's harder to get a loan today. So that's one thing, that credit growth isn't growing. Secondly, is the amount of debt that's out there is another reason it's not growing. So they want to get money into the system. They want you to go out and spend money. And if you don't have the money to spend, well, then how do you get that? Well, you simply create it. The government will either give you a tax cut, they will give you a welfare check, they will give you a food stamp, or they will give you some kind of money in some form or another to spend, kind of like what we did, let's say, in 2010, when the Obama administration put forth the idea we'll cut payroll taxes, because that meant more money in your wallet each week when you got your paycheck, because the government was taking less of your money in the form of taxes. So as she pointed out, they know, and it's one of the reasons why they've been trying to get interest rates normalized, they know that we're going to have another economic shock. They know that we're heading into another economic downturn. And right now, with the interest rates, I mean, all the Fed did was raise rates a quarter of a point. The only thing they've got is money printing, or if they can get the politicians to spend money, then the Fed can simply print it. That's another way of injecting money into the economy. And that's what you're going to hear. What is it, John? Is it Monday? The Republican convention starts in Cleveland. Look at the platform in what both political parties are proposing. Both political parties are proposing stimulus measures. One's going to be more welfare. The other one is going to be more stimulus. But either one of them are proposing deficit spending or basically helicopter drops, because they know, as a politician, you can spend the money and you can get Janet Yellen to pay for it. However, the first place that we're likely to see this is in Japan. Now, Bernanke was in Japan this week. It was a private meeting, but it's supposedly, this is the gentleman that, and we'll get into his helicopter speech made in December of 2002, but supposedly Bernanke is urging the head of the Bank of Japan, Kuroda, to work with the government and, you know, drop helicopter money to get the economy going, because Japan's in a recession. They've been fighting deflation for two decades. You know, it's like, what's next? Nothing else is working in Japan. So next is helicopters, because as right now, the markets are increasing speculation that Japan's next move is to unleash a major fiscal stimulus somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 billion for that economy, which would be quite large, and simply the Bank of Japan would just simply print the money to pay for it.
Well, since we brought up Milton Friedman, let's go back and hear what he thought about helicopter drops. And remember, this goes back several decades here.
You said rather optimistically, I think, that you have detected a trend wherein the public will accept a slowing down of the rolling of the printing presses. I confess that that trend is invisible to me, and I wondered what evidence of it you have seen.
I was really not referring directly to a trend to slow the printing presses, but a more fundamental trend in people's ideas and attitudes toward the role of government. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was widely taken for granted that there was hardly any problem, the solution of which did not reside in Washington, did not reside in throwing more money at the problem.
So there's Milton Friedman saying that throwing money at the problem is not the answer.
The problem is, John, that's exactly what they've been doing, and it's exactly what they're going to be doing again. And I want to go back to a speech that Bernanke gave, actually it was November 21st in 2002, and it was called Deflation, Making Sure It Doesn't Happen Here. And he talks about, and I'm reading from his speech here, he said, of course, the U.S. government is not going to print money and distribute it willy-nilly. Although, as we'll see later, there are practical policies that approximate this behavior. Normally, money is injected into the economy through asset purchases by the Federal Reserve to stimulate aggregate spending when short-term interest rates have reached zero. The Fed must expand the scale of its asset purchases or possibly expand the menu of assets that it buys. Alternatively, the Fed could find other ways of injecting money into the system. For example, by making low interest rate loans to banks or cooperating with fiscal authorities. There's a key there. And also low interest rates to banks. That's exactly what the ECB is doing with the banking system in Europe. And notice here, to the mention with fiscal authorities, what he's talking about here is helicopter money. Each method of adding money to the economy has advantages and drawbacks, both technical and economic. One important concern in practice is that calibrating the economic effects of non-standard means of injecting money may be difficult. In other words, they don't know what the results are going to be, given our relative lack of experience with such policies. Another way of saying, they're making this stuff up on the fly as they go. Thus, as I have stressed already, prevention of deflation remains preferable to having to cure it. If we do fall into deflation, however, we can take comfort that the logic of the printing press example must assert itself, and sufficient injections of money will ultimately always reverse a deflation.
You know, that speech back in 2002, it's now coming to fruition, but I'm wondering what makes him so sure he can generate inflation, because so far it hasn't worked.
Well, so far, all that money has been created. It hasn't really worked its way into the economy through the force of credit. Credit growth, once again, has been anemic in this economic recovery. But the reason he knows he can create inflation, and going back to that same speech, is he's given the reason why that can happen. And I'm going to quote here. The conclusion that deflation is always reversible under a fiat money system follows from basic economic reasoning. A little parable might prove itself useful. Today, an ounce of gold sells for $300 more or less. Remember that, folks, back in the days in 2002 when gold was $300 an ounce. Now suppose that a modern alchemist solves his subject's oldest problem by finding a way to produce unlimited amounts of new gold at essentially no cost. Moreover, his invention is widely publicized and scientifically verified, and he announces his intention to begin massive production of gold within days. What would happen to the price of gold? Presumably, the potentially unlimited supply of cheap gold would cause the market price of gold to plummet. Indeed, if the market for gold is to any degree efficient, the price of gold would collapse immediately after the announcement of the invention, before the alchemists had produced and marketed a single ounce of yellow metal. That's why you see, when you have these pronouncements, whether it's QE from the Fed or the ECB or the Bank of Japan, you see an immediate reaction in the market. It's the same thing. What has this got to do with monetary policy? Bernanke continues. Like gold, U.S. dollars have value only to the extent that they are strictly limited in supply. But the U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost. By increasing the number of U.S. dollars in circulation, or even by credibly threatening to do so, the U.S. government can also reduce the value of dollar in terms of goods and services, which is equivalent to raising the prices in dollars of those goods and services. We conclude that, under a paper money system, a determined government can always generate a higher spending and hence positive inflation. And the way they do that, John, is you have to get the money into the economy. And what is inflation? It's too much money creating too few goods. How do you get that? You give people a lot more money to buy stuff than what you produce. And that's what is coming next. So there is the justification. In those two passages I read, you saw a lot of that take place with loaning money artificially low to banks. That's being done by the ECB in Japan. You saw the money lowering interest rates. We saw that when they brought interest rates down to zero. You saw it with quantitative easing, with them printing money and buying assets. All of this stuff is taking place already. And right there with the printing machine and the fiscal stimulus, he's hinting at what needs to be done next, which is probably what he's advising Japan.
Well, we're coming up now on the conventions of both the Republican and the Democratic parties. And based on what's said there, we should probably get a good idea of future helicopter drops. Because right now, if you've listened to the jargon so far to this point, they're all recommending something. You know, we're going to spend it on infrastructure, which, by the way, is what we should have done with some of the early on funds that came out. But we didn't do that right after the crash. They're talking about infrastructure and then free handouts, free stuff, building up the military, everything that requires a lot more money. And no one's reckoning, as we were pointing out, that the Social Security is virtually bankrupt. They're running in a state of bankruptcy now. It's coming much faster than we had admitted. And we have all these other issues. So how this is all going to come together, I don't know. But the only answer would either be more taxes or more helicopter drops. And so if we take all of that as a given package, from an investment standpoint, what does this mean?
Well, I mean, investors are going to have to be more macro focused than they've been in the past, because macro forces are determining much of the returns in the investment markets. I mean, if you look at utilities, what's the macro force behind it? Yields on 10-year treasuries, interest rates go down, utilities go up. Likewise, if you take a look at financials, which have done so poorly, it's because interest rates have come down, which has squeezed bank margins. Interest rates go up, banks get more money. If you take a look at energy, well, what's that? It's the price of oil. In oil, by the way, there's a number of factors. There's four factors that determine the price of oil. And we talk about there's always demand, supply, and there's geopolitical factors. But also there's a fourth factor, which is called speculation. Much of the rise that we saw in oil prices in late 2007, in 2008, almost a third of that came from speculation. So speculation can also have an impact on energy. You take a look at raw material prices, the material sector in the S&P. It's influenced by the price of the dollar. If you take a look at discretionary spending, that's determined by what happens on the inflation front. The prices of gasoline go down, discretionary spending goes up. If you want to take a look at the other sectors of the economy, whether it's industrial stocks, healthcare, staples, that's determined by what's going on with the LEIs. So macro forces are becoming more important in terming investment returns. And just like in the stock market, what's been driving these higher stock prices isn't earnings or sales. It's higher PE ratios, which are accounting for almost 85% of the gain in the markets. So we're in this strange period until we hit the pivot point when they rev up the helicopter engines. And that's why you almost want a barbell approach. You want to be into short-term bonds and cash, in dividend stocks, in precious metals, in cash. So you have to have a balanced portfolio to take advantage of either outcome, because we know we're in this transition point and we know our leaders are telling us, folks, what is coming. Our politicians in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are telling you fiscal stimulus is coming. Our central bankers are telling you they're going to print the money to pay for it, and that the Congress, in fact, in Yellen's testimony in Congress, one of the questions that was asked to her by a Democrat, would it help if we spent money? And she said yes. So they're telling us what is coming. The problem is we have now until the time they rev up the engines. And so you need to be prepared for both outcomes.
Looking forward to the interview you're going to do with Professor Larry Kotlikoff on Tuesday as part of Lifetime Income series, because I know he has been an acerbic critic of how politicians are handling all of the developed economic situation there. Anyway, anything else coming up?
I just want to point out, it's interesting for those who know who he is. He's a professor at Brown University, considered one of the leading experts on entitlements, Social Security, and Medicare. He's written several books on it, and he's got a plan to fix it. But he's also a write-in candidate for the presidency in 2016. And he recently wrote an article saying that the unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare folks are not what they say they are. It's $199 trillion. So that's just a number that is impossible. So there's a plan to fix it. I'll be interviewing him, and we'll be playing that interview on Tuesday. But he is a write-in candidate for the presidency this year. In the meantime, well, what's coming up? We have a Fed meeting coming up next week. I don't think that's going to be much of anything. We are still plowing through corporate earnings season. This earnings season, the second quarter of this year, earnings will be down for the fifth consecutive quarter. But anyway, the world is awash in money, and that trend is finding its way into the financial markets.
So I guess we have what? Well, we're going to have silly season till the elections, but we have two more weeks of really accelerated silly season as we go through these conventions. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to watch it. But in all seriousness, you know, if I were an investor and I'm sitting here watching these conventions, and I understand all the hype and rhetoric, what should I be watching for?
You should be watching for helicopter drops. Watch both platforms and watch the number of times that speakers in both parties will be talking about new stimulus, infrastructure, minimum wage, more welfare, more free stuff. They are both going to be talking about spending, and that spending means larger and larger deficits that are going to be monetized. So I'm looking to the conventions to just to confirm our own opinion that what's coming next from politicians and central bankers is a helicopter drop. So I'd be looking at that, John. I think those are the key things that would confirm what's going to happen in 2017. So in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.